And welcome to the HalfGuarded.com Power Hour. I'm your host, Zachary Gilbert. This is my co-host, Dan Ford. How are we doing, Dan?
Oh, as good as can be expected.
Got the have you gotten through the sports blues of February? Are we ready for
Trying.
the beautiful spring sports season that has come
Sure.
upon us? Because we're
Sure.
not that far away from spring football, the most meaningless thing in all of football.
I mean, the spring practices are important. Obviously, the spring
Well,
game is still
I
not
think
worth a damn.
not for fans though. It's no, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be watching, but who cares?
You don't want to see orange beat blue.
Yeah, I do. I just know I don't care. Like, I'm not gonna get excited for it, but I am gonna sit down and watch. You bet your ass. Gotta get some football back, Dan. We're kind of at that weird moment where it's time to really start talking about football again because NFL free agency's kicked off, Dan. I don't know if you've been
It's the most
following some of the
wonderful time of year.
craziness that's been, yeah, some of the craziness that's been going on. We saw Alshon Jeffrey go to the Eagles. That's something me and West Coast West talked about, I think back in the fall, how if they can add a weapon like Jeffrey, the Eagles might look like a really nasty, hard to deal with team next year. So there's one. And then in Tampa Bay, it goes against the DeSean Jackson pair up with Mike Evans and
How did they get
Winston.
him?
Free
How did
agent.
Jeffrey get away?
I think the Bears are ready to kind of go in this weird rebuild mode, and they didn't want to give Jeffrey 15 mil.
Okay.
I say that, but then you signed Mike Glennon, your boy, former NC State starter, to all that money.
Yeah.
So my best guess is the Bears are just dumb.
I mean, when
I
in
think that's
doubt, the
fair.
Bears are just dumb.
Yeah, just dumb. And Jay Cutler released, so we'll probably see Cutler maybe go to the Jets. And then there was the big news today: Brock Urlacher traded to the Browns along with a second round pick for a fourth round pick. And this opens up speculation that Tony Romo may be a Texan. And we'll probably find that out in the next, probably by the end of the weekend, I would guess.
I mean, he doesn't. You know how it is about those Texans. Once they get stuck in the state, they're like, "I can't leave
I
this
can't leave
state.
this
This is the only
state.
place I've ever loved."
Yeah. And I think Romo with Houston would be, I mean, that's a pretty good defense. There's some good receivers there, obviously. With Hopkins, and you got, I'm blanking with the, I think the kid from Notre Dame they had last year. Jeffrey. Was it? I can't remember his name now. Will Jeffrey? Was that a person or make him up?
I think
Will
he made it up.
Fuller. Will Fuller.
Will Fuller is a
Yeah.
person.
Yes. Yes, they'll have him. And then if you had a Romo, that's an offense that's decent enough for a solid defense to carry. Lord knows they made the playoffs with Urlacher and Tom Savage as their quarterback. So
That
Romo would
division's
probably be
still
a step
terrible.
up. Yeah, still an offense. We've got the Jaguars. Titans are getting better. And I think the Titans are kind of the loser, the Jeffrey sweepstakes. I think Alshon on Tennessee would have been a really, nasty little thing to add. But we'll see what Tennessee does in the draft. Or I start giving him a hard time and wasting Mariota. That's kind of anything jumped out to you, Dan? The thing that kind of jumped out to me is like guys are getting a lot of money this year. It seems like a lot of that revenue is starting to come back into the players' pockets now
Well, they do
in
keep
the
raising
NFL.
the cap every year because
Yeah.
they're making so much money that they just keep raising the cap. So,
Yeah.
I mean, if you
I
raise the
mean,
cap, that means some guys are going to get paid. That's life. That's
yeah. I mean, it's
one of
just.
the irritating things in sports is when people freak out about contract sizes when in leagues where the cap has recently gone up. Like that thing people did in the NBA where it's like, "How can you say this guy gets a max deal?" And it's like, well, like the cap just went up like $30 million, so that changes things.
Yeah, and it was pretty crazy. And there were teams in the NBA that did overpay last year, Dan. I mean, the Lakers, obviously, with Mozgov. You saw what the Trailblazers did with adding Turner and overpaying Crabbe. There were still some dumb moves. But yeah, the money's a little bit different, and it's kind of easier to pay a guy a lot of money
But
now
it's
than it
not
used
like
to.
that. It's not like the money they got. Like if the Lakers or the Portland hadn't given it to him, somebody else would have. Because that's just the
Yeah.
going rate.
Yeah.
Like
But it
when the
looks like the
cap goes
Lakers,
up,
they're.
the going rate for players goes up too.
But it looks like there's maybe, if you wait, there's probably some better value there at the end of free agency. Because some guys didn't make a ton in the NBA last year. It seemed like some of the latter veterans to get signed later didn't make as much as you thought they might. So I thought that was interesting. But anything in particular that kind of jumped? Are you happy for your boy Glennon, NC State, Wolfpack?
I'm happy that he's finally got a chance away from Tampa to prove that he might be able to play. Because I think he's better than he got an opportunity to show.
Do you think there's something there with him? Like, I guess you saw him a good bit in college. Do you think that's a guy who can make it work? Yes. Or
I think I'm the reason. I don't know if we talked about this in the show before. I think I'm the reason Russell Wilson always snubs NC State because. When Russell Wilson was thinking about transferring, I wrote an article in the NC State newspaper, which you might be able to still find. I don't know. The internet exists.
Yeah.
About how Mike Glennon was a better player than Russell Wilson because Mike Glennon had two more years of eligibility, minimum, and Russell Wilson was just going to be one more year.
You know, Dan, I'd like to take that and like maybe CC it to old takes exposed or cold takes exposed on Twitter. That's a cold ass take right there. Okay, so our main topic today, Dan, that we're going to discuss, we're going to talk about programs that have disappeared or fundamentally changed in the way they operate, Dan. These are programs that don't really exist in the collective minds of football, college football fans anymore. And could we agree that a lot of these programs were pretty big in their heyday?
Some of them were definitely big. Like, we're talking about, yeah. You know, we'll talk about a former Big Ten member in one of the schools we're going to highlight. So yeah, I mean there's some major programs.
Yeah, I want to start off with this one, Chicago.
That was the one I was going to lead with.
Oh, okay. Well, it's perfect. Look at that timing. I want to start with Chicago because it seems like their kind of disappearance from football kind of led to Notre Dame being the biggest team in Chicago. Is that fair to say?
Notre Dame had already passed Chicago in Chicago. That was part. Mm-hmm. Chicago had three basic problems.
Okay.
One, they got really shitty, and that was Notre Dame's fault mostly, because Chicago was actually a pretty good team at the turn of the century. It's how they got in the Big Ten in the first place. But by the time you start getting into the 30s, Notre Dame has had their big rise in the 10s and the 20s. They're pulling away a lot of Chicago kids. It's not going so well for the Maroons, but you know, and that was one of the first things that took them down a peg.
Yeah,
but the reason why I want to talk about the Maroons is that in particular, they sort of encapsulate a problem that so many of these programs in this era that dropped off, because if you look at the number of programs that stopped playing football, a multitude of them stopped playing football between the years of like 1930. And 1950. And there's a couple of really basic reasons why. One, Depression.
Let's go into those reasons real quick.
One, the Depression happens. When you look at the schools that stopped playing football in this era, the one thing they all have in common for the most part, there's a few public universities in there, but for the most part, they're all private colleges.
Yeah.
Once the Depression happens and you have fewer people with money who can afford to go to college, private colleges start having to make cutbacks.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have taxpayer funding to keep them afloat during some lean years.
Yeah. And back then, obviously, football was not the moneymaker it is now. There was no television. Radio was just still kind of in its infancy. It wasn't in every home quite yet, I don't think, by the 30s.
Football would kind of be by the 40s. Football has always been a minor moneymaker, but nowhere on the scale of the, like, back then you made your money from the gate. And there were college football programs selling a tremendous amount of tickets. So I don't want to.
But it wasn't like the money we see now where a football program can support an entire athletic department, like Alabama football.
God no. So to speak. Not nowhere near the level of today. But there was a reason why football was the number one sport on most campuses. It did draw crowds. But you get to the point where you're having to make cutbacks because your university enrollment has fallen. Football becomes an easy thing to cut.
Well, and another thing, Dan, that, you know, kind of happened, that World War II. Well, so you have a lot less young men who can go play football because they're all fighting, you know, the Nazis.
That's point two. That was the second major cause. World War II happens and it decimates the college football teams in America. If you look during this period, the only two teams that had really any kind of success, and there's this weird phenomenon also, but the two big schools, this is Army and Navy's really their peak. Because Army and Navy were full of the best and the brightest kids who were going to be officers, because it's the war on, right? If you want to go be an officer. Yeah. They just end up dominating. And then another interesting thing happens is they start up these quote-unquote college teams that are basically like, you take all the guys who are enlisted in a certain region of the country and you make a football team with them, and it's like Navy Portsmouth or, you know, Army Des Moines. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just an all-star team of high school players that the Army or the Navy put together for morale purposes to have like a barnstorming football team in their region.
Yeah, so this is something the Army's actually done. This is something the Army's like kind of always done, especially like moderner era U.S. Army. My grandfather, played baseball for the Army during the Korean War. Entertained the troops while guys are out in Korea fighting in the jungle. He's in California playing baseball. Really sweet gig if you can get it.
Yeah, and the Army.
So that's something the Army does. So this was entertaining, especially back then when there's no TV, so internet. People needed stuff to go do. Sports was an easy thing for the Army to do to boost morale and to kind of help propaganda. You know, it's a good propaganda machine too.
And the premier college football program of the era was Army West Point. Like that was a legendarily great team that just destroyed people in that era. So. Yeah. The ripple effect that has on college football throughout the rest of the country is even the large public state universities like North Carolina, Michigan, you know, schools with huge student bodies barely had enough players to field a football team in this era. And so if you're way down the line, if you're the University of St. Francis or you're, you know, Creighton, you have no chance. You barely have enough students to keep the school running. Let alone having a football team.
Yeah, and I'm sure around this time, too, you probably saw a lot more female enrollment in college, or the proportion of females probably grew in some of these colleges, I would think.
I mean, this is when co-educational universities really start coming into existence.
So a lot of your student body couldn't play football, you know, because they're girls.
But the
girls aren't allowed
to. That was the state thing. I don't think the private colleges went co-educational as quickly.
Okay.
But
did the brutality really affect this? Because like football was almost outlawed at certain points in the 20s and 30s.
Very little, because don't really start seeing the drop off happen until the Depression starts.
Mm-hmm.
And then it really kicks up. The big controversies in football happen in the 10s and the 9s.
Did it help like with some people on those boards maybe didn't have a positive opinion of football, so maybe it was cut quicker?
Yeah. I don't think so.
Is that fair
I think that's kind of putting a modern perspective on the past. I don't think that was a big issue for them.
So you don't think like that necessarily had any, like there was, football had a pretty decent reputation with boards. Like this was a hard cut for schools to make, right? Yeah. This isn't like cutting maybe like your female, you know, polo team or something.
It would have been very difficult for a public university because almost none of the list, you can go through the list of schools that went defunct until World War II. You see very few public universities.
Yeah.
It's mostly private colleges. You saw like the third and fourth tier public universities in the state, like Old Dominion and Virginia. They start cutting it off in World War II, and they never really bring it back. But those are mostly like schools that didn't have a large student body on campus to begin with. You know, when you start getting down to the lower tiers of public universities, they start having enrollments that are about the same size as a private anyway. So they have a lot of the same student body issues that a private school would. But the third big thing that takes down schools like Chicago is the introduction of athletic scholarships in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Once the athletic scholarship comes into existence, thousands of private colleges make the decision, nope, I'm not doing this. We're not going to give out scholarships for athletics. And so you see a mass of schools either dropping out of football or dropping down to a lower level of the newly created Division III, which is a scholarship-free athletics.
Or the NIAA.
Or NIA.
Yeah. That's where a lot of these schools, like, so a lot of these schools you might see in D3 or NIA may have been, you know, maybe not the top programs, but around what would be considered like Division I. football back then, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair assessment? Like,
yep. So if we're going to speak specifically about Chicago, Chicago has two recognized national championships. You know, and obviously back then they didn't really award one. All of these are retroactive. None of them are anything to really crow about. I'm looking at you, Alabama fans, and I'm looking at you, Pitt fans. They didn't really crown a national champion in 19-dickety-1. But services going back in the past, analyzing the records, analyzing the statistics go, this team probably won a national championship. Chicago has two of them, in 1905 and 1913. They were an early dominant program in the Big Ten. They won the Big Ten in 05, 07, 08, 13, 22, and 24. Really, they were very, very successful in the Big Ten, in the early years of the Big Ten. Probably the first premier program of the Big Ten. So we're talking about a program that had a ton of success before the Great Depression hits. And they produced some of the best players of that era, like Amos Alonzo Stagg, you know, considered one of the great coaches and great players in college, early college football history, and a guy by the name of Fritz Kreisler, who went on to basically be one of the fathers of the Michigan Wolverines program. So, you know, Chicago produced an incredible amount of talent. They produced a large amount of teams. But once the Depression hits, their roster just starts to dwindle. Their football success starts to dwindle. World War II is what finally puts them out of the Big Ten. They dropped out of the Big Ten before they dropped out of football. And then the athletic scholarship was the last thing, was the last straw for them as a program.
Yeah. Well, and, but not the very end, though, Dan. Chicago is back.
They did. Like some of the programs in this era, they restarted football and have participated at the D3 level for like the last 40 years now.
Yeah, I believe so Chicago, I'm looking at now, the Midwest Conference of Division III.
Yep, they compete in Division III and have since 1973. But for the purposes of this discussion, I don't consider that. That ain't real football. There's no scholarships. They play in front of about 1,000 people. They basically play on, like, I don't know, you know, what they had at your college, but at NC State we had a field called Lee Field, which was like a general purpose field where students would go
like,
fuck around.
Yeah, like where you might see a lot of co-ed sports.
And you might see like a lot of people playing frisbee. That's the kind of field that Chicago plays football on today.
Yeah, and so most of these schools would get dominated by junior college teams.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Those top JUCOs in like Kansas and in Mississippi, oh God, they'd hang a half a hundred on this.
Yeah. Even I went to a Georgia Military Junior College, and they had a very dominant junior college football team, and sent a lot of guys to Georgia and the NFL. They were kind of the school where if you got in trouble in Georgia, you'd go there, and then you'd end up going to like NC State or Clemson. Be kind of what they do.
But when you look at Chicago and you look at programs like Chicago, they had a period of dominance in the early part of the history of college football because at the time when football really started, the programs that dominated were private institutions that could offer you a good education that people would respect. Yeah. Obviously, from the get-go, colleges have made allowances for football players and let guys onto campus who would have never been allowed into their school if not for football. That has been the case from the beginning. But the schools that dominated early college football were universities with such great academic reputations that a degree from that university would mean success in life. And so Yale or Harvard or Chicago University or Northwestern or Notre Dame or Stanford or take your pick, or Duke University, these were the dominant early era college football programs because they could come to you and say, look, a degree from our institution is going to have you set for life and you're going to have a job, which is basically what the modern programs do today. They say, you come to us, you'll be able to go pro. Back then they said, you'll be able to come to us and be a doctor even though you're an imbecile because of our institution has such a great reputation. What we see is as those programs start to drop off, they are replaced with schools like Michigan State. Michigan State is the school that replaces Chicago in the Big Ten. And what you see is the rise of the land-grant universities.
Yeah.
Because many of these schools either didn't exist or barely existed at the time college football was started. You start talking about a lot of these land-grant schools, especially in the South, we didn't even start having them until the 1870s.
Yeah.
So when football starts being played in the 1880s, these schools haven't existed long enough to start having extracurriculars. But by 1940 and 1950, schools like Michigan State, schools like Auburn, schools like NC State, they start saying, hey, we can play too. Why don't you let us play? And Michigan State gets into the Big Ten and is, I mean, Michigan fans will say it's bullcrap and they'll scream up and down the worst thing that ever happened was Michigan State getting into the Big Ten. But I think anybody with a brain would say, hey, that was a great trade. You traded a Chicago University program that would have never been successful again for a school that, you know, won a national championship in the 60s and became a dominant basketball program.
Yeah. Let's jump to another school I want to talk about real quick. We're going to jump out west. We'll talk about Pacific.
Can we say Pacific? Can we say
Pacific? Say Pacific? You,
say
what do you want to jump to next?
Because they're a more modern dropout.
Okay, let's. What do you want to jump to next? You pick.
University of Tampa. Now, the University of Tampa is really fascinating to me because they're kind of a sister college to the University of Miami. They're both private colleges. They're both based in what are now large Florida cities. But at the time they were founded, and at the time they were both playing football against each other, Tampa really wasn't that big a city. Miami really wasn't that big a city. And Tampa is, to me, the University of Tampa is one of the great what-ifs of college football history. It's why I'm so fascinated by them, and they're kind of the inspiration for this whole show.
Yeah.
Because the University of Tampa dropped football in 1974. That was right before the huge population explosion in the state of Florida took place, which is the reason why you can now look and see Florida has the University of Florida, Florida State, and Miami all as major programs in their state. Before that population explosion, they couldn't even field one, you know, major program. You know, Florida was a historical doormat in the SEC. But
FSU didn't even have a
FSU was a teacher's college.
Yeah. For girls.
For girls.
For girls.
Until the 50s. So Miami and Tampa sort of mirrored each other. Most of the time they were both terrible. Every now and again they would field a halfway decent team. And, you know, there's some notable players. I mean, the University of Tampa produced Freddie Solomon, who went on to a pretty good career. Their number one star would probably be John Matuszak, who played in the NFL for a long time for the Raiders.
Yeah.
And, you know, they produced a couple of big-time players. But they could never put together a whole team. And then the football team had terrible crowds. Nobody came to them. And they dropped their team. And anybody who's listening to the show, if you remember the 30 for 30 documentary on Miami, the U, the early part, like the first 10 minutes of that documentary, you're talking about how Miami used to give tickets away at Burger King. And there was more girlfriends in the crowd than there were fans. Tampa was at the same spot. And at the same point in their history, Miami hired Howard Schnellenberger, and he built their football program. And at that same point, Tampa threw in the towel. And one of the great what-ifs is, what if Tampa would have held on? What if they would have just held on for like another 5-10 years, and maybe they would have reaped the benefit of all that great Florida talent?
Yeah.
But they threw in the towel, and you know, nowadays, I mean, years later, you know, 20 years later, South Florida, the public college in Tampa, started a football program, and they've been very successful for a mid-major. I have a hard time not believing that South Florida couldn't have been just as successful, if not more so, because they could have gotten in on the ground floor.
No, and how would that Tampa, how would that have probably affected, like, FSU around that time? Would FSU have kind of risen to the same dominance? With that fourth school diluting the talent in Florida. I think you would have had less talent at all of the three schools that kind of stayed around. So maybe you don't have the dominant runs for Miami and Florida and FSU.
I think Florida would have been the team most affected. Because Miami and Florida State both hired great coaches at about the same time. And those, you know, Howard Schnellenberger and Bobby Bowden both built Florida State. And the fact that they both hired great coaches, I think they would have been fine. But as the state of Florida started growing, I could have seen maybe Tampa hiring a good coach before Florida did and sort of beating Florida to the punch or diluting things enough that the Spurrier era maybe never happened.
Or maybe, I mean, Spurrier famously played for he played in Tampa as a pro, am I correct?
He played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and his first head coaching job was with the Tampa Bandits. Tampa Bay Bandits.
Yeah, so I think you can realistically say that he probably would have been on the radar at Tampa for a job. So Spurrier could have built Tampa.
That's one of the great what ifs. Spurrier, like you said, spent so much time in Tampa. What if when the USFL folds, instead of him going back to Duke University, Tampa hires him? And he stays in Tampa. You know, basically makes the same move that the run and shoot coach made at Houston, going from the Gamblers to the Cougars. What if Spurrier does that at Tampa? That to me seems far more likely. And then he never becomes a Gator.
Yeah. So wild possibilities. I think the biggest impact, like maybe not something as crazy as Spurrier going to Tampa, I think it'd just be the overall dilution of talent for those Florida schools. Like, I'm not sure that Florida still probably wouldn't have had a good program. I'm sure they would have seen the same kind of dominant run they had in the SEC in the 90s, or FSU had in the 90s.
And the other very interesting what if is that Tampa kind of did hire their coach and they let him get away.
Yeah.
Earl Bruce, who went on to be the guy who followed Woody Hayes at Ohio State. Some Ohio State fans don't have a lot of nice things to say about him because he wasn't as successful as Woody Hayes. But I think overall you'd have to say Earl Bruce was a very good coach. He spent 1 year at Tampa and took them to their third ever bowl game and then left after one season. What if they would have kept Earl Bruce? Could Earl Bruce have been the guy who turned Tampa into a powerhouse? We'll never know. But it was right there.
Yeah, and you're sitting under a gold mine of talent in Florida that came in there. So, you know, and how many guys who stayed in Miami maybe would have gone to Tampa because their mom was like, well, you got to get out of Miami. It's, you know, not the safest place in the 70s and 80s. So maybe Tampa takes advantage of that. Something they can sell to moms. And that's, I think we've talked about with recruiting, half the battle is getting mom to like you. So,
And what we start seeing in the 70s, the pattern of programs dropping out is the effect of Title IX. Because once Title IX comes in, and you have to have an equal number of scholarships for men and women's athletics, obviously the football team takes up, you know, at that time, an unlimited number of scholarships. If you wanted to be competitive, you had to be giving out at least 100 scholarships, which means you then have to have 100 scholarships worth of that women's programs and a ton of private colleges that maybe had a successful basketball program or maybe had a successful what we would now call non-revenue sport like tennis or baseball. They all make the decision football's not worth it to keep a hold of. Because our attendance isn't that great. We're not doing all that well at it. Why are we throwing all these scholarships away for football? Let's concentrate on the stuff we're good at. So the programs that drop out in this era, you know, the University of San Francisco won the national championship in basketball in 56. Xavier. University of Vermont. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. University of California, Riverside. Maryland Eastern Shore, Seton Hall. You know, you start to see more public universities.
No, it's a quick note. Yeah, kind of a quick personal note. Mercer from my hometown of Macon, private Baptist college, dropped football for I think it was 50 years until about 3 years ago, and just kind of came back. It's tons of schools that you probably never even heard of that had football programs that dropped them off in the 50s and 60s.
But, you know, the 70s period, it's really Title IX starts having the biggest impact.
Yeah. Oh, it was in the 70s. I think Mercer dropped football. But like I was saying, how different do you think college football may be if some of these teams didn't have to drop?
Yeah, some of them. I have a hard time thinking the University of San Francisco was ever going to be a powerhouse, you know?
Yeah.
I have a hard time seeing that, you know, Seton Hall could have been a powerhouse, but... you know, schools like Seton Hall dropping out. I mean, what if when the Big East formed, Seton Hall was still playing football? You know, what if, you know, the 90s roll around and they start adding football to the Big East for Pitt and Syracuse? What if Seton Hall was still playing football and they had joined in that? How would that have changed the course of realignment in the last 10 years? Who knows?
And how would it have diluted talent? Like, I look at a school like Xavier. That's probably would have affected the Cincinnati kind of run we saw in the past decade. Sure. And probably hurts Ohio State to an extent.
And at this point, Cincinnati didn't have a football program.
Yeah.
You know, they were a lot of schools that we now think of as like, oh, that's a pretty good football program that are based out of commuter schools didn't even exist at this point.
Yeah.
So, like, if Xavier had stayed in the game and maybe hired a good coach, we know you can build a good program in the city of Cincinnati. Cincinnati ended up proving it. Maybe Cincinnati never becomes a thing in football if Xavier hangs around. You know, I've already mentioned South Florida. Maybe Central Florida and South Florida never get off the ground if Tampa sticks around.
Yeah, definitely not. South Florida, Tampa, but it's not really big enough to support, I don't think, two schools.
Right. So you're looking at a lot of these private schools dropping open the door for the commuter colleges in the next, who started up their programs in the next 15 years after this.
Yeah. So is there any other kind of programs you talk about before we kind of get to Pacific? Was there one more that kind of stuck out to you?
Well, let's see. You know, You also have the schools like New York University where you have a hard time even imagining that they ever had a football program because, like, NYU is such a nerd-ass school. But these programs used to have football.
Yeah.
Like Pepperdine used to have a football team. The fucking Malibu, like, stragglers out in Pepperdine used to play football. You know, isn't that crazy? Yeah,
so, and how do you think that maybe would have changed football? Like, let's say NYU does keep football, and let's say maybe it's a member of the Big East or something kind of crazy.
NYU's never cared enough about sports to be good at any of them.
Yeah. And New York, famously not a great football state.
Because they've always had pros. Football has always been over in New York.
Yeah, but I mean, just even for talent, there's not a ton of great talented football players from New York.
Yeah,
it's mostly, you know,
it's a basketball.
It's mostly
basketball.
In New Jersey. Yeah, it's basketball. And because it's easier to play, because if you have the giant city of New York City, a lot easier to play basketball than play football.
Yeah, there's no open, where are you going to have a place for people to play in a big open field in New York City? Yeah. There's not one.
And the money for the equipment, you know, all you need for basketball is like a ball and a net. For football, there's a lot of kind of extra things. That's why football is kind of hard to get off the ground.
Well, that's the other reason why there's that old saying about New York City point guards is that none of them can shoot, but they're all great dribblers because they have to sit there waiting for their chance to get on the park because there's a line like two hours long just to get on one of the courts.
So, but let's jump to Pacific. That's probably the most recent. I think I can't think of like a majorish kind of program that shut down recently except Pacific.
Yeah, I'm looking through the list to make sure that's right. The most recent would be University of Alabama Birmingham, who will close with.
But they're coming back. But they're kind of back. So, the University of Pacific drops out in the 90s.
You look at the programs that are dropping out in the 90s, you see a ton of schools in the state of California. So some of the reason for that is the UC system starts making these major cutbacks. And many of the UC system schools and the public schools start making cutback decisions on athletics. Because you have a bunch of hippies, grown-up hippies, running these colleges who are like, football? Who cares about football? That's something that people in Iowa do. And their programs aren't very successful. They don't draw a lot of people because most of the students are hippies who never gave a shit about football growing up. And so you just see this massive washout.
Yeah, kind of see it Cal now. I think Cal would be like a good modern day example of, like, most people don't even know that's Berkeley. They don't even associate that until.
Realistically, the only reason Cal is still playing football and basketball is because they ended up in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, like. Even though, over 75% of our faculty would like us to quit playing sports, we make money off of them, so we can't.
Yeah. We can pay the pension because we're getting that Big 12 TV money.
But when you look at, in the years immediately preceding University of Pacific dropping out, Cal State Long Beach drops, UC Santa Barbara, Cal State Fullerton, and Santa Clara all drop out. And I think a lot of the decision-making for the University of Pacific is tied into these are the schools that are around them, even though they're a private college. I think there's a little bit of, all of the schools around us just dropped. We're not drawing many people. Why are we staying in this?
Yeah. And what fun is it to play teams that, have no relation to... The fans aren't really going to interact in their day-to-day life. It's just not a good way to build rivalries and make money.
You know, the University of Pacific is located in Stockton, California, home of the Diaz brothers. And it's just like when all the schools that you used to be playing are dropping, and one of the other things with the University of Pacific, the independent, University of Pacific had been an independent for many years. Then they joined the Big West. When all of the Big West schools start leaving to join the WAC, or the Mountain West, or no, it was just the WAC then.
Yeah.
They're all leaving to join the WAC, so either the schools they either played have left to join a different conference, or have dropped football. Why keep playing? Nobody you've been playing is still playing. And the University of Pacific had not played in a bowl game since 1953.
Yeah, I believe, and so I was looking at the record on Wikipedia. Some of those bowls weren't even sanctioned bowls. They were I think the Grape Bowl and the Optimus Bowl, my favorite old bowl.
Sure,
one that definitely needs to be brought back.
I love the Optimism Bowl.
I think we could use some optimism. I'd like to see, I think if we sponsor a bowl, Dan, next year, I think that's our kind of our plan.
Power Hour Optimus Bowl.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
What's a very pessimistic sponsor?
Northrop Grumman.
Lockheed Martin Power Hour Optimus Bowl. Presented by Trump.
Donald Trump does the opening.
Yeah. We're really excited about this one.
But they played in back-to-back Sun Bowls.
Yeah.
You can't take that from them.
And they won the last bowl they were in. So they did go out a winner. They won the Grape Bowl.
And can you name a famous alumni of the University of Pacific?
No.
Pete Carroll.
Ooh. Was he there when football was going on?
Yeah, he played.
Ah, I didn't know that. So there you go. So probably the best football-related thing to ever come out of Pacific,
Pacific gets caught in this wave of realignment. Because as realignment starts really hitting conferences in a major way in the early 90s, some schools just get left behind. And Pacific made the choice, we've been left behind. Our alumni don't really care all that much about football. Fuck it.
Yeah. No one around us is playing football either. So, that's another, I think that might be one of the bigger factors. Is just, your friends aren't playing a game, why would you, Dan? It's no fun.
Nope.
So, but let's jump to our last team we're going to talk about, and that'd be UAB.
University of Alabama, Birmingham. So this is an interesting one, because on the one hand, there were very good reasons for Alabama-Birmingham to cease playing football.
Yeah.
Like the University of Pacific, they got left behind in realignment. One of their major rivals, Memphis, moved on to a better conference. The conference they were located in, Conference USA, became overnight dog shit.
Yeah.
They have never been able to draw many fans to their football games.
No, and really, realistically, only produced one major player I can think with the NFL, and that'd be Roddy White.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
My boy. Yeah.
They have never been able to get a stadium built anywhere near campus. There's never been any call to it, so they've had to play at a decaying Legion Field that nobody wants to go to because a block of concrete might fall and crush you to death.
Yeah. And you're competing against two of the biggest football programs in the country.
Never mind Alabama and Auburn. You're having to compete with Troy for the same level of players.
Yeah.
And at the time Birmingham made the decision to quit is when South Alabama started up. So now you had another school recruiting directly against you. And then Georgia Southern moving up, Georgia State coming into existence. So there were very good reasons for people at Alabama's system to go look. This program has not managed to be good in 20 something years, and it's looking like it's even less likely they will, and fans don't seem to give a shit.
Yeah, and on top of that, Dan, not to get political, but Alabama's not really a state that values, it's going to give a lot of money to education, if you will.
But especially not to universities. There is a nefarious side to the death of UAB. In many ways, the real reason they killed the program is because Bear Bryant's son, Paul Bryant Jr., who had a seat on the University of Alabama Board of Trustees, which also controlled UAB because UAB is a member of the University of Alabama system. Decided they didn't want UAB to ever be good and kill off the program so that they'll never have any chance of threatening Alabama, specifically Alabama.
Yeah, nobody on that board cared about Auburn being hurt. No. People that graduate Auburn don't tend to stay in Alabama. It's something I've kind of noticed too. They tend to go do things like run Apple. Not to brag. Because I definitely went to Auburn and all that, so I can brag about their alumni. I didn't. But yeah, these are factors that hurt UAB. The system was against you, basically. The University of Alabama system conspired against you. Yeah, so a lot of factors hurt UAB. UAB shuts down their program, and the outcry is kind of ridiculous there. The alumni lost their minds. Yeah. And the students did too. There were some big student protests.
Free UAB.
Yeah.
I remember I had that pin on my Twitter page for a while.
Yeah, and that's something else that I kind of want to bring up, Dan. You think if social media was around, like say when some of these other programs were closing down, maybe they would see there's a little more support for it.
The illusion that there's support, because I do kind of worry that UAB is going to start back up, have a 2 in 10 season, and then they're going to go back to having 5,000 people in the building, and we're going to be like, why did y'all not just stay gone? So Twitter can sometimes create the illusion that there's this mass consensus.
Yeah.
You know, like the people who, basically, I'm talking directly at hashtag wrestling Twitter, who want to tell you that there's this groundswell of uproar at the idea of Bill Goldberg. But all of those people making such a fuss, and so many people, this is the big thing social media changed. So many people immediately pointed out how dirty it was that Paul Bryant Jr. had such a hand in killing UAB football.
Yeah.
That would have never been a discussion 30 years ago. If you would have had a member of a board of trustees who hated a school and wanted to screw their football team over, nobody would have known about it or talked about it but the alumni. Because newspapers sure as hell wouldn't have wrote about it.
No, they're not going to touch that.
But because we live in this modern era, people directly went at Paul Bryant Jr. like, you're a piece of shit, and I'm going to destroy. I'm going to make your life hell. And I think guys like that are like, ah, fuck it. Yeah, bring their football team back. I'm tired of getting hate mail. I'm tired of people yelling at me.
So UAB does return.
They returned this year.
And what conference? Conference USA still?
Conference USA. Conference USA. Yep.
There you go. So I think that kind of concludes a brief history.
Of different programs.
Was there any like readings you kind of want to recommend that maybe you ran into on your search for information about these programs? Maybe a book, a movie?
I would say, obviously, rewatch 30 for 30, like I mentioned, especially when you're talking about the University of Tampa. But Bill Connolly's new book out, The 50 Greatest Programs of All Time. I would say that's a great book because it doesn't just talk about 50 teams. He uses those 50 teams to talk about the history of college football. And I think you get a great understanding of how the sport sort of ebbed and flowed. And I think that would be that was an invaluable resource.
Somebody that's something to check out. As we get to our kind of our closing ceremony here, Dan, I want to bring up something. We discussed Royal Rumble about a month ago. It's WrestleMania season.
I did mention wrestling Twitter.
Yeah, so we're talking about it, and I'm not that excited for WrestleMania anymore. I don't know if WrestleMania 30 was just kind of the peak for me as a fan or what, but I mean, I'm going to watch the show, but I'm not too excited. I can't imagine too many fans really are.
Yeah, look. I think we both love WrestleMania 30. And I think part of the reason was it felt like a new thing was dawning. And then the reality was is that almost immediately after WrestleMania 30 ended, it went back to being the same old show.
Yeah.
And it's been stuck in that same rut ever since.
I think in reality, it was more, should have been like a nice farewell show for maybe my, and it kind of was as my fandom as a hardcore fan. I think that's kind of it. I think, do we want to discuss WrestleMania 30 next week, Dan?
I think that would be a great topic for next week.
I think that'd be fun. I think that's what we'll do, because that was an interesting time in my fandom that kind of brought me back to the WWE and made me kind of leave it forever, but it's always going to stay in the background for me. But more specifically,
once you move on from something, the thing that brings you back rarely makes you stay, because you moved on for a reason.
But I want to kind of talk about this one, because I am, you know, I know the internet, we mentioned the internet's not, I'm hyped to watch Bill Goldberg fight Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, I don't care that they're, like, having their head up their ass.
Yeah, I don't care that they're not building stock. Like, yeah, I'll disclose I do own some WWE stock. But I don't really care if they build up stars or not. Who gives a shit? I want to watch Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg fight because I want to feel like I'm 10 years old again. I think a lot of fans want to do that.
I mean, in that reality, here's the thing, and we'll maybe talk about this at another time, but there's people who always want to go sky is falling with WWE, but if you look at the history of that company, the later years of Vince McMahon Sr. were just as shitty.
As they are now.
For the same reason. Vince McMahon Sr. got old and started thinking he was smarter than everybody else. And stuck with Bob Backlund even though nobody cared about him. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? And, you know, eventually he got replaced by his son, who turned out to be a genius. And now that guy has become an old idiot. And Triple H is raiding in the wings. And I think he'll do the same thing Vince McMahon Jr. did. It's just, there's an old guy in charge, and he's kind of dumb now.
Yeah, but here's the other big thing with WWE now. They're going to make money no matter what. They built a beautiful corporate structure. That kind of makes sure WWE is going to be very profitable for the next decade or so. This isn't a company that's bleeding money. They're going to continue to make incredible profits and have one of the biggest streaming networks around,
They're going to be profitable unless something big happens in TV rights. Their TV rights falls off, then they suddenly become not so profitable.
But it looks like this is a company that's going to be in great health. This isn't, say, WCW. At the very
end. It's not going to just die one day.
Yeah. Because there's no one to pull the plug like WCW, because they are the owner of their company. And B, they can make the same mistakes because they're smarter at making money. They're just, Vince McMahon's one of the best American businessmen ever. And I don't think it's enough credit because he's in such a weird industry, but that makes him far more interesting to me. Probably the most interesting, he's probably up there with Ted Turner and my favorite, capitalists ever. Maybe not favorite as people, but favorite to kind of look at and study.
He's had an interesting life, and it gets undersold because he's a carny.
Yeah.
But he's
that makes him more interesting to me. Like, he's a carny, and he's friends with the president now, and his wife's in the cabinet. It's like...
Our president is a carny.
Yeah.
Think about how much more interesting life would be if Vince McMahon had gotten elected president instead of Trump.
I think that's the shame, that Vince McMahon wasn't picked to be VP. Because I think we were all kind of hoping for that.
Surgery guy. I think if he'd never gotten that bad plastic surgery, he could have been on the ticket.
So, but yeah, I think next week, Dan, I'm gonna rewatch parts of 30. Let's take some notes and let's do like a review. Yeah. Old, you know, going back to my one appearance on your wrestling
the power
show.
Power Hour. Oh no, this is the Power Hour. Your what was that show called? The Fire Pro Podcast.
Fire Pro Podcast. When I was, I don't remember anything of it. I was very drunk. This time I will be sober for the review. So
you did make. I think you got the hardest laugh any of us ever got out of Brian on air.
What was that? I don't even remember what it said.
I don't even remember it either. I just remember being mad that you got Brian to laugh louder than I ever did. And I was like, God damn it.
It's also where Velvet by Undertaker was really a heel the whole time. And Ted DiBiase was actually the face. Because the Undertaker was a zombie. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's one of my favorite takes ever. So I think next week we're going to take a look at that. That was kind of a defining moment in WrestleMania. And I think we might do a little preview in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
For WrestleMania to get you ready. Because I know a lot of you, if you're listening, you're probably going to probably watch WrestleMania.
I mean, come on. What sports fan doesn't watch WrestleMania? Yeah. Or at least, like, kind of.
And you'll get to see The Rock do stuff. Why would you?
I mean, he might show up and light his name on fire again.
All right, Dan. And before we get out of here, I want to wish Jason congrats on the sex. He had a kid, apparently. So he's got a little baby at home. So registered sex ever. Yeah.
The legendary at Oansun, Oansun, the man who does our music, the man who did the original music for the Fire Pro Podcast, which has already been mentioned on this show once. Great person, tremendous fella, and now he's a father. And I can't think of anybody better to be bringing a child into this world and teaching it and training it up the way it should go.
Yeah.
Than our beloved friend Oansun.
So. Congrats, and best of luck.
Best of luck. And I know he doesn't have a lot of time these days. I know, you know, a newborn, that's a busy life. You know, not a lot of sleepless nights with the newborn. But I will ask, if he can, play the music, Jason. Don't wake the baby.